Sean Pesh, the founder of Randmore, a South African who is based abroad but knows all about what's going on in the South African asset management industry because that's where he started off. Let's pick up. You have very kindly, at my request, gone into Palantir. Now, I'll tell you the request for this, Sean. We have had 6 big changes in the world over the past few months. It's almost like there's been a seismic shift in what's going on. And we have model portfolios at BizNews that have done phenomenally well. But when you have a look at Trump in the United States, Warren Buffett building a massive cash pile, selling shares like they're on sale, the new here in South Africa from a South African perspective, potential of Third World War with Putin and Biden doing things that are almost inconceivable at the moment, and our futurist here in South Africa, Clem Sunter, saying that there is a big flag now waving for World War III. He puts the chances of it happening at between 10 and 20%, which is far too high if you consider the consequences. You put all of that together and you've got your best performer. It's done 600%+ in the portfolios in Palantir, which by my calculation, if it grows at the next 30 years, will mean it's going to take me 21 years before I get the money back from the current market cap. I think that it's right to be nervous, not just about that, but of some of the other stocks. We have got a 10-bagger in there called MicroStrategy that has gone up 10 times in the last year and a bit. It is a Bitcoin play. But let's dwell on Palantir, and thank you for doing the work for us. And you can take us through so that we can now assess this. And you're not allowed to give advice on buying or selling, but you certainly can provide us or empower us with proper information.
Yeah, that's right, Alex. So I guess the first point is this isn't advice, and we can't provide advice. And I really did this for educational purposes. I did a video some time ago over Christmas when my wife was on call. And in fact, unfortunately, I can't come to South Africa this year for the same reason. And I walked through an income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow statement. I think I just did the income statement, balance sheet, whatever, for a company. And I got lots of positive comments. So I know there's this active BizNews community. I thought, let me do something similar. If one or two people learn something new or find a new way of thinking or whatever, that's great. So this is really for educational purposes. Do your own work. And I have zero exposure. I'm not long this position in the fund in my personal capacity. I don't trade in my personal capacity. All my money's in the fund, etc. So I have absolutely nothing to gain from this, okay, other than trying to help teach some people.
Before you start, I've just got to put in perspective who Sean Pesh is for those who are coming in for the first time. Yesterday, I had Magnus Haystack and Piet Viljoen talking about their Million Rand Challenge. And Magnus said what he's doing now is he's taking all of his offshore money and he's giving it to Sean to manage. So that puts some kind of a perspective on the reputation that you have here. And of course, we know that you have been ranked amongst the top 1% of asset managers in the world. So this is good advice. Not good advice, good insights, good analysis.
Thanks, Alec. Well, so the first thing I want to do, just trying to, whenever I'm looking at a company, I've got the luxury of Bloomberg, but quite often I'll go to the investor relations page. So just type in the company's name, investor relations, okay? And this is Palantir quarterly results in the SEC filings, which is the Stock Exchange Commission filings. So we'll dive in, and often the place I'll start is the latest quarterly report. Why do I start there? Because it's a bit shorter than the annual report. The annual report in some cases might be 9 months old. I want to see what the latest information is. I don't want to be looking at something that's been, that's 9 months old. So I always go to the quarterly report. Obviously, if I like what I see, I will then go and dive into the annual report. Or if there's something that I see in the quarterly report that I don't understand, I will refer to the annual report. So in the US 10Q quarterly report, right, here we go. So what I've got here is I've got the income statement, and you'll notice 3 months to September and then 9 months. So they're 3/4 of the way through the year. So I'm going to walk down the income statement and just show you a couple of things that I picked up on. So revenue's up 30%, great. For the 9 months, revenue's up 26%. So that means in the latest quarter, they've had an acceleration of growth. Okay, so that's good. Great, let's carry on down. Gross profit's up 29%. And that is a 80% gross profit margin. That's high. So that's good. That's what you'd expect from a software business. Great. So all good so far. 16% operating margin. That's the 113 million divided by the 725. I was a bit surprised that was as low as that. You know, Microsoft has 45%. I think I'm right in saying the likes of Oracle have close to 30%. So software businesses should be very scalable. You expect a high operating margin. The next thing I notice, interest income is 52 million. Now that happens to be 46% of operating income. So a high level of interest income. Now there's good and bad. The good is that actually interest income's up from last year. Great. Well, we know interest rates are higher, but it also means there's cash on the balance sheet. Okay. We want cash on the balance sheet. You don't earn interest income if you don't have cash on the balance sheet, but it is a high percentage of income from operations. So in other words, when you're putting a high PE on earnings, bear in mind that you're applying that high PE to interest income. And if interest rates start falling, hard to grow 52 million. Okay. So that's just another thought. 4% tax rate. That's quite low. You know, profitable businesses pay lots of tax. So I'm not sure why it's only a 4% tax rate. But if taxes were to go up, that'll suppress the growth. So let them, you know, if they're probably using historic losses, and we'll touch on that in a second. Income attributable to non-controlling interests. So what that means is they've got a stake in a business, but there's also some outside shareholders have also got a stake. That business has obviously been doing well because you can see there's growth there. So they're not getting all the cream. Okay, we've got to bear in mind there. And earnings per share up 100%, 6 cents, great. But weighted average shares in issue, 2.2 billion. Weighted average on a diluted basis, 2.4. So there's a 9% dilution coming from share options. Okay, so that's one's just got to bear in mind that you think you're going to get growth, you're going to give some of that growth to your employees. Okay, so that's the income statement. A couple of things to just, you know, a couple of thoughts that as we go through, we just want to be aware of. Here's the balance sheet. So this is comparing to September to December. The first thing I like to look at is what's the current asset position? What's the net current asset position? So we've got net current assets of 5.3 billion of current assets, 900 million of current liabilities. Now, what that means is there's no immediate short-term, you know, pain. It's not like they've got current liabilities right up, you know, as big as current assets. So they totally reliant on selling stock to pay the creditors. One's always got to be, it's a very liquid position, what I'm seeing here. Okay, so that's good. I can see that cash is up a lot, or marketable securities is up a lot. Now, I don't know, is that being from the profits or have they raised debt on the other side of the balance sheet? And then, you know, you got your debt and now you put the cash there. We'll see as we go down the balance sheet. Accounts receivable, so those are debtors, those are your clients, is up quite a lot, 300 million. So those are clients that haven't yet paid. Okay. What worries me is this 92% of the third quarter revenue. It's the other way to say, so 92 days in a quarter, I think it's 85 days. Now, if you've got a client, Alec, somebody who's advertising in your thing and haven't paid you for 85 days, quite long, not great. Okay. You want your money, especially. So that's a bit of a worry. I don't like it when you tell me you've got sales, but then the guys haven't paid you for those sales. So one's got to just bear that in mind. Okay. Property, plant, and equipment, only 40 million. This is supposed to be an IT business. Everyone's spending a lot of money on AI and billions that we talk about the CapEx at Google and Microsoft. This company, supposed to be leaders, only 40 million of property, plant, and equipment. Not a lot of computers there. So maybe there's some in the operating right of use assets, the lease right of use assets, but just something to note. Okay. And one of my concerns is the declining deferred revenue. Now, what is deferred revenue? So if I come to you, and let's say I'm a software provider, Alec, and I say, okay, Alec, I'll send you my software and I'm going to give you a maintenance contract and it's for the next year. Okay. So you pay me, £120,000. I can recognize some of that now, but because I've got to look after your systems for the next year, I can only recognize, you know, that as the time passes. And so the portion that I can't recognize as income now is deferred revenue. Now, growing businesses have increasing deferred revenue. Okay. If you go and have a look at Salesforce, et cetera, as you're growing, you take your new clients, you're adding their deferred revenue. Yep.
An example of that is in our business, when you subscribe to BizNews Premium,
you pay generally, because it's cheaper, you pay the full 1,440 Rand upfront. But we could not, if we were a listed company, we could not recognize that all, because we've got to give you a subscription for 12 months. So we would only, say it was 1 month in, we'd only be able to recognize one in income. The other 11 would be deferred revenue. So that's another example.
Correct. Now, as your subscriber base has been growing, has your deferred revenue been going up?
Indeed.
Yeah. This deferred revenue is going down.
Hmm.
Okay. That's the point that I wanted to highlight. Now, they also have customer deposits, which is quite different. I don't often see that other than if you're looking at a bank. And the difference between customer deposits and deferred revenue is deferred revenue is contracted. Customer deposits is, and I had to go and refer to the 10K here, we're going to try your product out, give you some money. If it doesn't work, we want our money back. Okay, so it's, you know, if somebody cancels their subscription halfway through the year with you, you're not going to give them money back because you agreed to pay. You just paid it up front. You took the upfront deal. Okay, you're not giving it back. If you had a deal whereby you'd give them back half their subscription, that's customer deposits. So customer deposits, in other words, the contracted business is not growing. Okay, the uncontracted business has been growing. Right. So another concern there for me. A capital, $10 billion is up $600 million. Great. But they've accumulated deficit. This is the historic situation. Okay. It's like they've lost $5.3 billion cumulatively since they started. That's a big number. Okay. And that's probably why their tax rate's lowest. And you know, you don't see that in the likes of NVIDIA and, you know, very profitable businesses, et cetera. Okay, they've started making money now, so that's historic. Maybe they've turned the corner. Great. Bear that in mind, though. You've got to bear that in mind. Okay. Let's go to the cash flow statement. Now, the cash flow statement, they're showing 9 months. Now, what we'll do as analysts is that's 9 months, but hang on, I want to see the cash flow statement per quarter. You've now got to go through the work of, say, well, what was the cash flow statement last quarter to derive the cash flow statement for the latest quarter? And that's what us as analysts do. I mean, we will build detailed models going back 10 years, all these line items. So we know what the story is. All right. So this year we're looking at 9 months. And what do we see? Stock-based compensations is $410 million. That's 20% of revenue. Okay. So that's the value of the shares that they've dished out to the staff, the share options, is 20% of revenue. It's a big number.
Just explain that. In other words, if I was coming to work for you and you said to me, look, I can't pay you £10,000 a month, but actually I'll pay you £10,000 by giving you shares in the company, but I'll only pay you five, but I'll give you the other five in shares or in share options. So they'll only be worth something if presumably the share price goes up. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's what we're talking about. But remember, if I'm giving you a share in my business, there is a cost because you're going to take some of my dividends down the line. Okay. So in the income statement, it's saying it's a cost. In the cash flow statement, it's saying it's not really a cost, okay? Because I didn't pay you in cash. So we at Randmore, what we do is we actually take that off the cash flow. We say, listen, there is a cost to that, okay? Don't come and tell me it's nothing. So, but not everybody does that, all right? So we go down the line items here. There's the accounts receivable. There's an outflow of $311 million. That's the increase in the accounts receivable. The guys who haven't paid you, they've taken, you know, the sales you've made, but they haven't given you money. It's effectively an outflow, okay? Because you never got that money. All right. And we've got accrued liabilities, which are, you know, expenses that you've probably paid the next day or the day after quarter end. So we don't really, that's a low quality cash flow item. And customer deposits. So they say, well, hang on, the customers who've given us money, that's actually an inflow. And it is, but remember, they can take their money out. Okay, so you get the total and it says, well, there's 694 million of cash generated from operations. Yes, but 150 of that is from customers who could take their money out if they cancel. And another 400 of that is stock-based compensation. Okay, so 59% is stock-based compensation. So I look at this and I go, this is poor quality cash flow. That would be my analysis. Okay. They only spent $9.5 million, which is lower than last year on AI. I mean, and that's, what about the AI that everybody else is spending? Okay. And how about this for a number? This business has received $270 million in the 9 months. Because remember, okay, let's come back to that example. I gave you share options, but my share options weren't for you to buy my business at naught. It was buy my business for £1. Okay. This is the £1. It's the cash that you paid me as part of the share options. So when you cashed in the options, there was an exercise price. This is the exercise price. 270 million. I mean, operating income is only 293 million. So this business has generated almost as much cash from employees cashing in share options. Cashing in share options as they have from the actual underlying business is what I would say. Okay.
So let's just understand that, Sean. I've got share options in Palantir. I work for Palantir. I've got share options at a price of $40, which is very high when I first go there.
Yeah.
That has to be accounted for as
stock-based compensation.
Stock-based compensation, because at some point in time I had to. And now I see the share price has gone to $60. So I can go and cash in those shares. I pay you $40, Palantir. I take those shares, sell them on the market, make a $20 profit. But the $40 that I'm paying Palantir goes into their cash flow statement as income or as cash that comes into the business.
It comes under the financing activity. Proceeds from the exercise of common options. Okay. But when you look at the cash on the balance sheet, don't just think, oh, this is such an amazing business because it's so profitable. Some of that cash on the balance sheet has come from employees cashing in the options. Okay. So you can see that through each of these financial statements, I've got questions here about, you know, I've run through the questions that I've got. So let's just carry on here. So now in the quarterly report, I want to show you something. There's 50 pages of risk factors. Okay. And if you're putting your own savings on the line, you know, we at Ranmore, we go through these risk factors because we're investing client savings. We want to know what the risks are. And we want to know what the risks and why do the companies put them there? Because if they don't put them there and a risk comes to pass, was manifested or whatever, they're going to get sued. So they think of every risk factor, but it's very good. Now, it's quite tedious, doesn't make for the most exciting bedside reading, you know, reading through 50 pages. But if you're putting your life savings on the line, you better read them. And you better be doing income statement and balance sheet and cash flow statement models because, you know, this is not the casino. Anyway, I went through some of these risk factors here. I kind of got to enough. Our top three customers account for 18-17% of revenue. Well, that doesn't sound too high until I noticed in the notes that actually government is 56% of revenue. So this top three customers must be various government departments, not the government as a whole. All right. You've now got 56% of your revenue is government, and we got Elon Musk now going to try and save $2 trillion for renegotiating contracts. Okay. And actually, the government, I saw in one of the risk factors there, the governments can't procure for more than a year. It's part of the laws there, all right? Many of our contracts, including our government contracts, contain termination for convenience provisions. Customers that terminate may be entitled to a pro rata refund, okay? Another risk factor. We historically have not realized all of the revenue from the full deal value of our customer contract, and we may not do so in the future. So there's lots of, you know, I'm going, well, hang on, why have you not received full value? Oh, well, it's because of timing and there's a whole lot of stories. But I'm going, there are some risks here. You've got the US government as a big client, okay, with a change underway. If they were to lose one contract, of course, everyone's going to go, well, what about all the other departments? I don't know. You know, I'm not suggesting for a second they're going to lose me. I'm just saying it's a risk and people need to be aware of you. All right. We face intense competition in our market. The market for our platforms are very competitive. We expect competition to increase. A significant number of companies are developing products that currently or in the future may compete with some or all of our aspects of the proprietary platforms. I mean, they're telling you they've got intense competition. Okay. Now let's look at the main guys. Let's look at management. This is the main guy, Alexander Karp. What's Alexander doing? If you go to SEC filings 4144, you can see what they've been doing. Sold during the last 3 months. 18th of November, the Americans do it the other way around. 18th of November, he put in a sale sold a million shares, got 64 million of proceeds. 15th of November, 4.5 million. In fact, I did this last night. There was another filing last night after I did this. Okay. In total, this is only going back to the 28th of October, 1.3 billion of sales. The CEO is selling every day. Okay. Every day. Follow the money. The CFO, this is interesting. I went there to look at CFO, and I like to look in LinkedIn. What is the person's history and all the rest? Interesting, he's a corporate securities attorney, and he studied law. Now, this is going to sound strange to South Africans because you think, well, hang on, the FD or the financial director or the chief financial officer, it's got to be a CA, surely. interestingly, in America, that's not the case. Less than 40% have the CPA, which is Certified Practicing Accountants. Okay, so less than 40%. Most of them are MBAs. So 51% are MBAs. I mean, call me biased because I qualified as a chartered accountant, but you can see there's some complex stuff we've been doing. I want a proper CA on the case. Now, I have no doubt that they've got CAs, you know, further down, but I do think, for me, I find that quite useful. If you go and look at many of the large tech companies, you know, you've got a proper EPA. I'm sure this guy's extremely competent, etc. But it's just something else that I would just mention. And it's useful to just go and look at these guys. You know, LinkedIn's available to all of us. You can go and look at LinkedIn and see what the person has done historically. Right, let's just get our sense checked out. So we've got all those risks. We know the CEO is selling. We've got a couple of questions in the accounts. Let's just have a look at this. Right, so market cap, 148 billion. I've got a whole lot of others here. 148 billion, Unilever. We know all these companies. This is the earnings before depreciation tax. All right. And I've done it simply rather than get into involved enterprise value. I'm just taking the market cap divided by the earnings before tax and depreciation. All right. Palantir is bigger than all those guys. I've used the diluted. They're expected to make one. It's 153 times. Okay. So it is out there in another Palantir. Okay. It's not another Palantir. So then you say, Alec, well, hang on. Yeah, but Sean, they're growing. All right, they're growing. So what I did is I went to Yahoo Finance. I mean, I've got access to Bloomberg, but it costs us thousands a month. And actually, Yahoo Finance is quite a useful tool. It's available to everybody. And I went and said, well, we will build models, and that's what we do as analysts, and it'll take us a long time to go through and come up with what we think the company could earn. But if you want to short circuit that, go and have a look at Yahoo Finance. You can see next year, the analyst consensus is 47.6. The highest is 57. I tell you what, let's just pretend the highest is right, okay? So let's build a little spreadsheet. Not a complex spreadsheet, but just a tiny little spreadsheet. Right, so they earned 25 cents. That's trailing 12 months. Next year, the guys on Yahoo Finance suggest the highest is 57. We're going with that. And then we're going to add 25%, and that kind of lines up with what my Bloomberg is. Okay, the forward PE is 88 on that number. Mm. Now, that is a break-even PE. In other words, what you're expecting as an investor today is you need earnings to go from 25 cents to 71 for the full year and the PE to be 88. And guess what your return is then? Naught. Okay.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's what your return is. Naught. If that is achieved. All right. But let's say, well, we know businesses mature. Companies on 88 times earnings don't stay 88 times earnings forever. So at some point, the growth curve slows. And when it slows, you know, and the company matures, and maybe it matures 30. So let's just put it on 40 times earnings. Well, then if I take the 71 cents and I put on 40 times earnings, well, then I've got a $28. If I take 71 cents, put on 30 times earnings, 21, 25, it's 18. I don't know what the number is because I don't have any faith in that 71. I haven't done the work. But I'm just saying this is what other analysts think. If that happens, you use 54%, 66, 71. Okay. So then I put all that together and I go, yes, but, you know, this is what people will say. They'll go, no, but listen, Peter Lynch, don't you remember Peter Lynch? He used to say, selling your winners and holding your losers is like cutting the flowers and watering the weeds. Okay. And I go, yes, but Peter Lynch also said this. You have to say to yourself, if I'm right, how much am I going to make? If I'm wrong, how much am I going to lose? That's the risk-reward ratio. So what are the facts? The facts is we have no idea what's happening in the future. The facts are the CEO has sold $1.5 billion in recent weeks. The facts is everybody thinks this is going to be the next NVIDIA, but what happens if it isn't? And, you know, be careful about anchoring yourself to the one of the biggest winners in recent times and thinking, well, every company is the next NVIDIA. And how much are you prepared to give back and lose, you know, if you're wrong? Because, yeah, so that's how I would approach it. And then I've got a little saying, you know, the growing the flowers and cutting the weeds and all of that sort of stuff. Remember, every flower dies. Okay. And what you want to do is you want to get the flowers out the garden when they're peaking, put them on your mantelpiece. Let them enjoy the last few days, enjoy them, and then go and find another flower. So there we go. That's some, hopefully some of your members of the Business News Investing Community find, you know, learn one or two things here, find it useful. But that's some thoughts.
Wonderful. Do you want to just stop sharing your screen and we can see your full face then?
There we go,
Sean. That really was superb. Thank you. The insider sales is something that we don't pay as much attention to as we should. I met Alex Karp in Davos 2 years ago. I was mightily impressed by the man. I listened to him in a couple of the sessions. It was the summer Davos in May. I remember it well. Introduced myself to him, had a brief chat with him as well. At that stage, Palantir's share price was around $7, $8. And that's when we put it into the portfolio because they were busy in the process of building 5 different software units that would mature in the months ahead. And he was very confident that the sales were going to come for those 5 units or 5 packages. And indeed, that in a dangerous world, Palantir was a very useful partner for governments to have. So that's the shtick, if you like. That's the narrative. That's the story. From what we've seen, governments might want that, but they also might want to cut their costs in the United States and elsewhere as well. Governments are under austerity issues. And on the other hand, there must be other people trying to produce the same kind of software that Palantir now has. It claims to have an advantage because it was ahead of the game in producing software. But I guess it's not like NVIDIA, where this is you can only get the chips from NVIDIA. At the moment, you can only get the software, if it's that good, from Palantir. But there will be others who produce similar software. Is that a logical approach?
I think that's very logical, Alec. I think that makes complete sense. I mean, if this is so profitable, this is such an amazing market, okay, then others are going to follow. And remember, this number's a rounding error for Oracle. Oracle wanted to get into that business, or Microsoft, they could offer this for free. You know, $111 million operating income. I mean, $700 million is a rounding error. You know, so I don't know. As value investors, we don't know what the future holds. Okay. And nobody knows what the future holds. The question is, if you don't know what the future holds, don't pay too much for it. Because if you're wrong, you saw the percentage losses there. And the other way to look at it maybe is, I don't know what percentage Palantir, I mean, it's been an amazing call and well done, you know, is what percentage is of the portfolio today. Okay. But let's say it's 10%. I don't know what the number is.
Well, it's 17.
17. Okay. If you didn't own it, would you buy a 17% position today?
After what you've told me, no.
There we go. So think about what position you would own and sell it down to there. And you know what? If it goes up, rejoice. Okay. Alec, I remember I did a VAC job, and I can't remember whether I've told you this before. Leon Kampfer, I did a VAC job at Cypherts way back when, and I had a coffee with Leon Kampfer. He was, you know, shared some insights, and we're talking 1992, so a year into Investec Asset Management's business journey. And I said to Leon, what advice would you give a young guy like me? He said, always leave a little bit on the table for the next person, because they're allowing you to take your risk off the table. Okay. And so you actually, you know, so I always approach it. I'm going to sell it, and I want it to go up a little bit because I want the next person to be rewarded for letting me take my risk off the table. Okay. Not too much, but anyway, sorry.
It's a very interesting approach, because to try and time the market is always exceedingly difficult. But I guess if you believe that a stock that you've bought has now reached a level that you would not buy it in future, then you have to start looking at it in the way that you're talking about, as an active manager, rather than, for most of us, we don't have the time, we don't have the expertise or the skills that you have, which you've just unpacked for us. So for us, if we're going to buy a company or a stock, it has to be a pretty good reason to no longer hold on to that share. When in your world do you start looking at that as, hang on, I've had a good run here, I need to reassess?
I look at my numbers and I go, what's my potential return from here? So what is my exit multiple? What's my return from here? And and what are my other opportunities? I mean, how many other companies out there are you potentially exposed to 70% drawdown? Because remember, if you don't sell when the going is good, okay, when it starts falling, you you're filled with regret that you didn't sell, take some chips off the table back there. And now you've got a whole emotional loop that you get involved in. So one of the things I like to say is if I got 90% of the juice of the lemon, that's fine. Let the other person squeeze a little bit harder and get the pips. Yeah, I don't want the pips. I want the easy juice.
And you would, in a case like this, even though you've had a wonderful run, you would retain some of the stock in your portfolio?
What, if I owned this, I wouldn't buy any of Palantir today.
Okay.
So that's my, because I'm just, I don't want to expose my clients to minus 70%. And why am I going to buy when the CEO is selling $1.5 billion in recent weeks on the eve of NVIDIA, which may or may not surprise an upside where, you know, there's massive change in the US and all the rest. I mean, this is not for my money. Forget it. I don't care how good the story is.
Now, NVIDIA, it's a little unfair for us to be talking about this with you right now, because as we are talking, the results are coming out this evening. But when you look at that, look beyond the results, are you also having a similar unease about the valuation that we're seeing on NVIDIA now?
I mean, you know, I can't get those numbers. I can't get the numbers to work. And I go, you know, their customers are developing the chips. It's wonderful. They're going to be hiccups. There's always hiccups along the way. Look at this, you know, Supermicro, one of their third largest customer that's auditors left. Now they've found a replacement. It's too hot for me. And we prefer to go where that place they've been overlooked. And people are ignoring it. That's where you find the value. You know, you're trying to buy a holiday. You're trying to buy a summer holiday flight in the middle of peak season. You're not going to get a good deal. I want to buy my summer holiday season, you know, summer holiday tickets in the middle of winter when the airlines are looking for some cash and are prepared to give us a good deal. So is there a good deal on NVIDIA? No, not that we can find. You know, I don't really have a view. I think it's getting harder and harder. You know, they have shown enormous growth. It's going to get harder to grow from here. And maybe they're surprised on the upside, but we try and invest in companies at a prices we think make great sense. Okay. So I'm not trying to guess what they're going to beat the estimate, miss the estimate, none of that stuff. That we don't play that. Other people can play that. And I'm not trying to guess what other people are going to do as a result of that. We're just going to, you know, get rich slowly, as Warren Buffett said.
Doesn't this also, though, depend on your view on money? When you're looking at money and you're saying, I want to be sure that I'm getting value for that airline ticket. I want to be sure that I'm not throwing my money into a hot area, as you described it a moment ago, because I'm not sure I'll be the person who can actually hit the exit first. Whereas there would be others who perhaps feel differently. They feel the wisdom of crowds is what should be guiding them.
Yeah. I mean, there's another book. What's it? The Madness and Delusion of Crowds. So we've got to be careful which crowd we're talking about, Alex. But, so it's all about the return. And what you're trying to do is get great risk-adjusted returns. And so that's when you invest sensibly. And value investing just makes sense, Alex, whether you're looking for a car or a holiday or a, you know, why is Black Friday so popular? Why is Singles Day so popular? Because people want a deal. As soon as it comes to stock market, it's like, well, no, hang on, I don't want a deal. I want to go for the latest what thing in the hope that it goes up. So they're each to their own. And hopefully that for the, you know, hopefully for the NVIDIA investors, it'll be good. Anyway.
Sean Pesch, the founder of Ranmore, giving us some magnificent insights there, Sean. Thank you for all the hard work that you've done on this, particularly at this time with so many things changing, with seismic adjustments around the world. We shouldn't look at the narrative. We should look at the facts. And you've given us the ability here to look very carefully at the facts. Sean Pesch is the founder and chief investment officer at Ranmore. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.